This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I'm Jewish. I don't want to speak for the Jewish students or faculty. I think there's a wide range of views. There are almost surely some who approve of what the administration is doing, but there are many, many, I can assure you, who do not and do not want this done in our name.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with atmospheric scientist and Columbia University professor Adam Sobel about the havoc that's currently being unleashed on the scientific community by the Trump administration. We look at how these draconian measures could hamper the progress of mankind and learn more about an academic funding system that relies heavily on federal research grant money. Then we turn to the alarming arrest of recent Columbia grad Mahmoud Khalil. We discuss his plight and what it tells us about this administration's open disdain for the U.S. Constitution. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Adam Sobel. Adam is a professor at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and Engineering School. He's an atmospheric scientist, and he also hosts the Deep Convection podcast. Adam, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Pleasure to be back.
So you wrote a piece just a few weeks after Trump's recent inauguration. It was posted in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists entitled "How the Trump Administration Could End a Century of American Scientific Dominance." That was over a month ago, and I'd like to get your perspective on the impetus for the article, and then maybe later in the discussion we can kind of see how it's played out over the last 5 weeks or so.
So at that time, the Trump administration had just started what has become a daily set of attacks on science, as well as other aspects of government and other institutions. But what had happened so far at that time, if my memory is correct, is that the administration first ordered a freeze on all government grants and contracts, if I remember right, which was then a little while later stopped by a court order. And then they also ordered a freeze, a reduction of indirect cost on National Institute of Health grants, NIH grants, to 15%, which is a lot lower than some institutions currently have agreements with the government to charge. And we can talk about what that really means, because it's, when you say it, it's often misunderstood what that really means. But anyway, those two things, the notion that the government would think of unilaterally doing those things was profoundly shocking to American scientific institutions of all kinds, because they just, you know, the federal government has agreement with universities and other kinds of research institutes that you get a grant, you write a proposal, you say we're going to do this and that. If it gets peer reviewed and if it gets approved, you get the money, and there's a grant or a contract that says you're going to do these things and this is what we're going to pay. And, you know, all that has operated in more or less the same way since not too long after the end of World War II. And modern research universities, as we know them in the United States, and to some extent other countries too, operate that way. And that's how U.S. science works. And that's why we're a country that's great at science, and people come out from all over the world to study and work here in the sciences. So this was just completely disruptive to that. It was like the government saying, you know, we don't want to do this anymore, and we can announce this, you know, from one day to the next. So even though those actions got stopped by court orders, first of all, some of it, I mean, the overhead reduction from NIH is still, I believe, stopped by court order. The freeze on grants and contracts was also rescinded, but some things haven't really restarted anyway. I mean, it's unclear to me whether the administration's fully complying with that court order in particular. And there's been battles over, you know, USAID and the others. for a while they were stopping the NIH study sessions, which are basically the proposals where the gatherings where they review proposals. So through an administrative mechanism. So it's sort of, they do these backdoor things to sort of gum up how it all works. And I understand that's been sort of unfrozen, but I don't really know where it is. So, I mean, it just sent a profound shock through the whole U.S. scientific infrastructure. I mean, how can we, because even though some of these things get blocked by court orders, the idea that the administration would even want to do these things, and is willing to fight in court to do them, just suddenly creates huge uncertainty, at a minimum, I mean, and fear about whether we're going to be able to keep operating, even with grants that have already been allocated, right? Even when we're not talking about, there's always the threat of congressional, you know, Congress reducing the budgets of the agencies for next year. So your proposal might, you know, the amount of funding might be decreased for new grants. But the notion that the federal government's already given you the money, now they're going to suddenly take it back. I mean, we've hired people, you know, we've made commitments, you know, based on those agreements with the government. So it was just absolutely terrifying. And you could already see how it's sort of, it's particularly shocking and fear inducing for the young scientists who come here for their careers, or they've grown up here and they're pursuing their scientific careers, understanding that this is how the system works. I mean, it's always competitive. It's not easy to be a grant funded scientist, but you know, there's the game is played a certain way and you learn how it works and you try to do it. And for that to just be, for the administration just to try to stop that overnight, that's what I was responding to. So since then, you know, some of that stuff's been rolled back by court order. As I said, you know, some of it's unclear where it stands, but they've done a whole lot more things, firing people from all kinds of agencies. A lot of people have been fired from NOAA. I think 10% of NOAA's workforce already, and maybe another 10% in process, if I understand right. A whole lot of people were fired from NSF. I think some of those have been rehired in response to a court order, but definitely not all of them.
For our listeners who are not familiar with some of these acronyms, the NIH is the National Institute of Health, and NOAA and NSF, maybe, I don't want to screw those up, but maybe you can tell us what those stand for.
NIH is National Institute of Health. National Science Foundation is NSF, and that funds all fields of science. NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is part of the Department of Commerce, and it funds weather and climate science and oceanography, and also has the National Weather Service as part of it. The National Weather Service has taken big cuts. You wouldn't think that even a Republican right-wing administration would be against weather forecasting, but de facto they are, because, you know, Musk wants to cut everything. All the agencies, I mean, U.S. Geological Survey, what are the other agencies? I think Department of Energy, I'm not sure if they've gotten to yet, but NASA's having cuts now. And we don't know the full extent of the, I'm talking now about cuts to staff. So the agencies fund research externally, meaning they send money to universities and so on, but they also do science inside the agencies by their own staffs. And those people are being fired, many of them. And they started with firing, you know, just the probationary employees, which are people who have been in their jobs for less than a year, or in some cases it could be 2 years, I think, but generally less than a year, which can be young new hires or sometimes people who've been there a long time but just got promoted, so they're in a new position. But a lot of it is young scientists, and this is just, you know, if you're interested in government efficiency, firing the young scientists is the absolute worst way to do it, because first of all, these people have lower salaries than everybody else. Second of all, they're the future of the agency, so it's just the absolute worst way to do it. A lot of times they have the best technological skills because young people have learned all the new stuff, whereas old dinosaurs like me often don't. So like everything that the Department of so-called government efficiency is doing, these firings at the agencies they've just fired whoever was administratively easiest to fire, rather than there being any plan for the agency to do its mission in the most efficient way. There's been no even pretense of trying to do that, other than the name of Musk's, you know, outfit.
Yes, I was just talking to a friend of mine who's a doctor at Johns Hopkins and gets a good portion of his grants through NIH, and you've probably read about the Johns Hopkins cuts that are happening. I was talking to him about it, and he'll be fine. You know, he's a doctor. He has transferable skills. He could go back into private practice, and I assume the same thing would be true for someone like you, tenured faculty member at Columbia. You'd have options if your grant funding
dried up. But as you said, these up-and-coming scientists are in a real pickle right now.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's old guys like me. I mean, I have tenure, so I'm probably not going to lose my job, although the university is trying to kill my university too. So that's another story that we'll probably get into. But for the young scientists, you know, it's not just the threat that they might lose their jobs, but it's also that because these cuts are hitting everywhere, because the administration's going after all of science and especially anything environmental and climate related, which is my field, the market is going to be flooded with unemployed young scientists and many fewer jobs. I mean, the private sector can pick up some people, but it's you know, nowhere near enough. So it's just, that's what's really awful about it, is the people we've been training at universities, but also for the country. I mean, you know, if you want to make America great again, why was it ever great? Well, science was surely part of that. And most of that was possible because of government support.
It doesn't make sense economically. One recent economic study that you cite from the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas found that non-defense R&D spending overall paid returns of 150 to 300% and was responsible for a quarter of the United States' productivity growth since World War II. It's cutting off your nose to spite your face and pretty much playing against this country's strengths in so many ways. I can't help but wonder, you spoke about how up-and-coming scientists are going to be in the crosshairs and maybe discouraged from pursuing their fields. But what about undergrads that you're coming in contact with who are considering getting into the science field? How do you think this may have an impact in terms of our scientific progress over the next few decades?
For the undergraduates, it's not just discouraging, it's also closing down their options too, because as grants are cut or at least threatened across the nation, across all fields of science, then, you know, the next step for an undergraduate who wants to be a scientist is to pursue a graduate degree. And in the natural sciences and engineering, graduate students do a lot of the research in labs and universities, and they are paid by grants. And so with these grants being cut and threatened, there are fewer graduate students being admitted to do their graduate degrees. And that is happening right now, I can tell you from firsthand experience. So, you know, it's closing down also summer internships even. I mean, this is for real. So it's going to turn young people away from science. I mean, I think part of, you know, the cutting off your nose to spite your face, you know, that study from the Dallas Reserve Bank of Dallas, I mean, I'm not an economist. My guess is that they're probably underestimating the benefits of science. It's hard to assess them because government-funded research is generally public. It's generally open, unlike a lot of industry-funded research, meaning that we do the work, the government requires as a condition of their paying for it that the results be put out there in peer review. I mean, you can patent things under some conditions, but a lot of it just gets put out there.
And how do you measure those externalities, right? There's so many different inputs that go into that calculation.
That's right. So in other words, the cost is easy to measure. The government spends so many dollars on a grant. The benefits, you know, those discoveries get out there in all kinds of ways. And because people don't really have to pay for them, you know, how do you trace down how these things are measured? All you can say is that every modern technology we know of has some roots in federally funded science. I mean, you can talk about computers with the semiconductors that make the chips. Now with AI, I mean, the industry is now private sector and tech has spent a lot of money to do its own AI research, but the roots of it, you know, going back, sure has plenty of government funding behind it. This administration and the Republican Party generally for the last decades has this privatization mentality that's in favor of privatizing everything. So benefits that flow to the public good get undervalued, and government-funded science is very much in that category. The benefits aren't narrowly concentrated in private hands, and so that makes them harder to measure, but it also makes them less valuable. You know, Musk sends these emails harassing the government employees and threatening them. And one of the early ones, the fork in the road one, where they were encouraging people to retire, said, we want you to quit your public sector job and get a more productive private sector job. I mean, it's just so insulting, you know, these people who are serving the public for relatively low pay, to just denigrate them as though, you know, government doesn't do anything valuable.
I mean, you kind of saw it coming in the early 80s when Ronald Reagan was famously quoted as saying the scariest words are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." This idea that government is the problem, and then you put people who don't believe in government in charge of the government, this is what you're going to get.
Right. I think that's, you're right. That's where the Reagan was the start of it. Yeah, it's been taken to an extreme now.
Bars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell. And there's no one there to raise them. It's just my job 5 days a week. A rocket man, a rocket man. And the thing's gonna be a long, long time to touch down. Not the man that thinks I am not home. No, no, no.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Adam Sobel. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences at Columbia University. So, Adam, let's get back to what's happening at your university. You said that it's under fire from Musk's DOGE, but it's also been charged politically, as much as we've seen since the 1968 student protests. We had a university whose student body was very much involved in protesting the war on Gaza, and now we're seeing a backlash from the Trump administration. Can you catch us up on what is actually happening there and what the mood is amongst you and your colleagues?
So we had the protests around Gaza in, oh geez, I guess it started in 23 and got really heated in the spring of 24. And that was a very painful period, and I think for the whole university, and I think very much analogous to 68. But now, in the last couple of weeks, we've had this ferocious assault from the Trump administration, where they have first announced that they were gonna cut $50 million of grants, and then within a few days, they said there was gonna be $400 million. And I don't know the exact number, but they have in fact canceled a large number of grants. Maybe it's not 400 million, but it's something close to that, I believe. Most of it in the medical school, because that's where, in fact, most of the government funding goes. I mean, my field is government funded too, but medical school is much larger. So that's the first thing that happened, and they've threatened to cut the rest of it. I think I read somewhere that Columbia's annual operating budget is $6.6 billion, and something over a quarter of that is federal funding. So with a total outstanding grant obligations of something like $5 billion. So that's like, you know, let's say it's 1.6 or something per 1.7 per year. So about three times that is $5 billion, which makes sense because typical grant is 3 years. This is just my own math based on what I've read in the paper. So I'm not saying any proprietary information here. I don't have any inside knowledge of the Columbia budget. But so that's just terrifying, because, you know, you cut a large fraction of the university's budget, and threaten to cut in the rest of it. It's really, really scary. Nothing like that is, I believe it to be illegal. I mean, the administration's excuse for doing it is that because of the university tolerated anti-Semitism in the protests, we could get into, you know, that characterization of things. But even if it were true, I mean, the university has been investigated under Title VI, starting even under Biden, but there's a whole process for that that takes a long time, and the administration hasn't done any of that. They just, by fiat, announced they're doing this. So I'm no lawyer, but almost certainly illegal. So that's the first thing. And then This fellow Khalil, who I didn't know his name before this, but he's one of the student. He's not a student anymore. He graduated, I believe, got a master's degree, if memory serves. But he was a student here and was still living in university housing. He's a permanent resident, green card holder, married to an American, and his wife is 8 months pregnant. This is all, again, just things I've read in the paper. He was involved in the pro-Palestinian protests, and he was one of the people who negotiated with the university on behalf of the protesters. And he was just abducted by ICE, and at first they told him, well, we're going to cancel your student visa. And he said, I don't have a student visa. I'm here on a green card. And they said, we're going to cancel that too, and they took him to Louisiana to some detention facility and are threatening to deport him. It's now, you know, it's being fought in court. But I mean, this is absolutely terrifying. I mean, there's some, you know, some law that the Trump administration claims they can invoke here, but he's not charged with any crime. Nobody has claimed that he's done anything illegal. It's just that by being a pro-Palestinian, you know, activist, he's been associated with Hamas. Nobody said he's had any contact with Hamas or has done anything with or for Hamas. It's just, you know, his views might be construed as sympathetic to Hamas, and I'm not going to characterize, this is what the administration says. I haven't looked at anything he's said carefully, but no matter what he said, I mean, there is freedom of speech, even for people who aren't citizens in the United States. So to just take somebody and do this is absolutely unconscionable and terrifying to all of our foreign students on campus, of whom we have many from all over the world.
And is this protecting the Jewish students in Columbia? I would think it would actually be having the opposite effect, because it's just building bigger rifts within these communities.
Yes. I mean, I'm Jewish. I don't want to speak for the Jewish students or faculty. I think there's a wide range of views. There are almost surely some who approve of what the administration is doing, but there are many, many, I can assure you, who do not and do not want this done in our name. Besides which, if you really care about the Jewish students and faculty of Columbia, you wouldn't try to destroy the university. I forgot to add, first, the Trump administration canceled all this funding, and then last Thursday evening sent a letter demanding that the university take a range of steps outlined in a bulleted list of something like 10 things as a precondition for negotiations on having a further, a continued financial relationship between Columbia and the federal government. And these lists of things include putting a department in receivership, which basically means taking making the department be run by somebody from outside the department, making the campus police able to make arrests, just eliminating the university judicial board that adjudicates, disciplinary actions in students, and making the president have responsibility, the president of the university have responsibility for that, banning masks in protests, a bunch of other things. A couple of them are sort of not that unreasonable, but, you know, would take some deliberation, and this was had a deadline of a week to respond. A whole bunch of them are just, in my view, the administration can't do these things. To do these things would be to take away Columbia's institutional independence and make it a puppet of the Trump administration. So the Trump administration it's been characterized, this is not my words, but I'm paraphrasing somebody on social media, but I think it's accurate, said that the university basically said, we will destroy Columbia unless you destroy it first, to the administration. And I think that's accurate. So this is simply awful for everybody at Columbia University. And by the way, for the rest of United States academia as well, because if you think they're done after this, if you think they just destroy Columbia and be satisfied, I mean, you know, I've got a bridge to sell you.
Yeah, and Columbia has a $15 billion endowment or something. They have a cushion. It's not part of their operating budget, but they're one of the most deep-pocketed, most elite universities in the world. So there's a lot of other universities, one can imagine, that are going to be even more on thinner ice financially as these funds keep getting pulled from them and getting conditions attached.
Yeah, I mean, there's just no, there's no precedent or legal basis for the federal government to come and tell a university to come in and try to micromanage it at this level with no process, no nothing. I mean, it's just, it's inconceivable. But you're right. I mean, I think it's easy to overstate this Columbia's what Columbia's endowment means, because yes, it's something like $15 billion, if my memory serves, but the annual operating budget is, you know, close to half of that. So, and most of it's committed anyway. I mean, it's endowed, somebody, you know, it's a collection of endowed. So somebody gives money to endow a professorship. You're not allowed to spend the principal. The interest, you know, pays that professor's salary. So it's not a slush fund the university can just use. And even if it did, it would be gone pretty quickly. So even Columbia is much more vulnerable than the endowment might make you think, but you're absolutely right that other institutions are even more so. And so this is just, you know, I mean, it's clear that this administration is opposed to all independent institutions, you know, that have some kind of, you know, ability to say what the truth is. I mean, journalism, academia, etc. It's assault on independent centers of thought and information and potential opposition in the country. And we are ground zero for it, but the rest of academia and journalism and so on should be very, very concerned. Law firms are now being targeted if they were, you know, if they worked with Trump's perceived enemies. And that's, you know, a threat to the rule of law, because if people can't get a lawyer for fear of the government, because the law firms are afraid to side with enemies of the government.
Or legal forum shopping, the way the government's engaging with Khalil by moving him down to Louisiana to a more, to the fifth federal district, where it's a little more onerous for somebody like Khalil to fight for his civil rights. You had the less friendly districts. It's called forum shopping. So we see them, you know, shuttling people around and using exposing the inconsistencies of the judicial system.
Yeah, I'm not sure that might be less new. I'm not sure about that one.
It's less new, but it's also being exploited in such a bold way that I don't think we've seen before, in such a obvious, blatant way.
Right. But trying to use this kind of brute force against academic institutions, journalistic outlets, and law firms is... I'm no historian, but in my reading of the coverage of this, it doesn't seem to be any precedent for any of that, other than maybe McCarthy. But I think this exceeds even that. And I got to say, like, you know, doing these things, I've even started to think, oh, geez, should I be outspoken on this? Should I be going on record and saying, you know, if I can't do it, what's tenure worth if you can't do this? So I don't know. I don't think I'm target number one.
Well, I really appreciate the time. Adam Sobel from Columbia University, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome. Thanks, Alex. Sway the future to the past and find what will
endure. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the Beastie Boys and Elton John.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.